And there we go. So we're getting there. Unfortunately, we lose 5 minutes every class with the bloody machines. And 5 minutes because the previous teacher leaves. Thanks. Terrible person. Okay. And that. Come on. And it's the right size, it's the wrong size. I think it can be 150. 150. Good. Getting that slowly. So, what do you know about William Blake's life? What do you know about William Blake's life? He was a painter. Above all, he was an engraver. An engraver? An engraver is somebody who uses chemicals to make cuts into a piece of stone, I think it is, granite or something like that, and then can make multiple images, which he then painted by hand. Yes, anything else?
Yeah, he the only formal education he had, he was a heart, a 10, a thief, a he came as an apprenticeship as an engraver. Or, no, Chinese. That's he can afford to do that. The rest of his life had been making down some books.
Yeah. Good. So we know that he was from basically a poor working class background, really from the artisan classes, the craftsman classes, and those of course are the classes which are under pressure from the Industrial Revolution. He is very, very different from all of the other romantics, both of the first and the second generation. Most of the romantics travelled extensively in Europe. Wordsworth walked all over the place in France and, of course, spent a lot of time in the Lake District. Coleridge, I think, spent some time in Germany. One of the ways of understanding the two generations of the Romantics is that the first generation can be seen as the German-influenced Romantics, and the second generation are the Mediterranean Atlantic Romantics. Even though most of the poetry, I think practically all of the poetry of Keats, for example, we have, is before he went to Rome to die. He's already, in the poems we see, he's already talking about the Mediterranean as a sort of idiom. And certainly that's a very big part of Keats, and Lord Byron spends a lot of his time in the Mediterranean. So if you can think of it in terms of sort of German influence, especially Coleridge, and therefore quite a lot of Gothic influence in the first generation, and in the second generation Mediterranean. But that is not the case with Blake. Blake is a Londoner. He spends a brief time in the countryside, I think about 6 months, and hates it. He is a city man. He's somebody who loves London, and London is his environment. All of the rest of the Romantics are interested in nature, in terms of sort of green fields and trees and pretty birds and things like that, which is fundamentally different from Blake. Blake believes in the natural man, in the sort of Rousseauian, if you can say Rousseauian, I don't know what the adjective for Rousseau is, a natural man, but he is very much associates himself with the city and doesn't even very much like the countryside. So that's a fundamental difference, yeah? Blake belongs to the first generation in terms of age. But he, whereas Coleridge and Wordsworth are friends and then enemies and then friends, and they have this sort of silly masculine relationship of loving each other and hating each other and eventually loving each other again. William Blake has nothing to do with them. Wordsworth thought that Blake was mad, and Blake thought that Wordsworth was not a very good poet. Blake was not mad, and as far as I'm concerned, Wordsworth was not a very good poet. He's not part of the same group. Blake is very, very much part of the same group as Thomas Paine. Supposedly, he was the one who said to Thomas Paine, "The police are coming for you," and Thomas Paine fled to America. The writing man, yeah, Thomas Paine. He was a friend, and he worked with Mary Wollstonecraft. He was a friend of William Goldwyn. So he was much more part of that radical, non-conformist group than the Wordsworth and Coleridge, who were anyway much more to do with the countryside, much less to do with London, and doesn't have the greater to do with the younger generation. The only connection with the younger generation is through the fact that Mary Wollstonecraft's daughter, Mary Shelley, married Percy Bysshe Shelley. That's the only connection that he has. But otherwise, he's very much part of that London group rather than either of the other groups. And as I said, there's no love lost between them. He doesn't like them, and they don't really like him. For me and for a lot of people, he is probably the greatest poet of the Romantic generation, with the possible exception of Keats, who's also bloody wonderful. At the time, he was completely unrecognized. Nobody really gave very much attention either to his poetry or to his painting, etc. And a lot of people thought he was mad. He did tend to see angels in strange places. So, for example, he saw, "The sound is awful. Okay, I'll see what I can do." Are you sure the sound is awful, or is it just because I'm talking in English? Is that any better? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Can you hear me? There's no sound at all. You don't hear me at all. No? Yes. Okay. Well, start again then. We don't know very much about Blake's life, but... Okay. We don't know very much about Blake's life, but he is very much a Londoner, and he's not part of the rest of the Romantic movement. Of course, the second generation Romantics, if you like, were much more aristocratic. Shelley was from an aristocratic family, and Lord Byron, obviously, his name was Lord. His name was George, but he obviously was aristocratic. In that sense, I suppose you could say that there is a certain connection between Keats and Blake, and that they were both from a much less affluent London origin. But Keats was taken under the wing of people who were more affluent, like George Brown, and also by Shelley. Lord Byron didn't think very much of Keats, but Lord Byron didn't think very much of anybody, really, apart from Lord Byron, but at least he was funny. So, blah, 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 blah. In terms of painting, his tradition was very much carried on by somebody called Samuel Palmer, and you may want to check out Samuel Palmer's art as well. Both Samuel Palmer and Blake are fantastic as painters as well. Basically, what we have is a very different thing, things that happen with people's reputations from this period onward. Nobody gave anything for Blake's poetry while he was alive, his reputation has basically grown and grown and grown and grown constantly until, certainly until the 1960s. It hasn't declined particularly since then. On the other hand, Wordsworth, people got very unimpressed by Wordsworth in the 20th century. There's a bit more, people are a bit more magnanimous about Wordsworth now. Similarly, Shelley was hugely important in the early Victorian period and has had a bit of a relative decline. Keats has tended to ascend and ascend in terms of his reputation. So it's all, they tend to go in different directions. Coleridge, again, as a poet, has tended to decline. His literary criticism is seen as valuable, but he's less well considered now as a poet. Right, so what we're interested in is Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience. Songs of Innocence was produced first as a standalone thing, and then Songs of Experience was added to it. And having written Songs of Experience, the collection always appeared together. It is important that you are aware of the subtitle showing the two contrary states of the human soul. And it is a very important idea for all sorts of romantics, this idea that children are born innocent, they are born innocent, and there is a special place in God's universe for those who are innocent. But it takes a special type of education and a special type of mind to maintain your innocence. Yeah?
This innocence and experience.
Sorry?
The title Songs of Innocence and of Experience. Isn't it
an to some extent, yes. Experience makes you what Coleridge would describe as sadder and wiser. So as you live through life, it's difficult to maintain your innocence, although you should try to. You see how there are very negative things in the world, and you react to those. So you're likely to, with experience, become sadder. But if you can maintain a certain level of your innocence, then you will have a more global, a fuller view of the world. So, being an adult brings fears and anxiety, what Marxists would call, alienation. So you understand the world more deeply, but more painfully. The combination of the two leads to a higher truth. Blake believed that innocence could be reborn. You could reconnect with your innocence at any time if you were given the right circumstances. So the world without innocence is perceived as a barren place of oppression. And a lot of that oppression comes from the new capitalism and from the new industrialization. There is an awful lot of, there's an awful lot of bad things happening. The destruction of the green spaces in London, children being sent up chimneys, which was very typical of the Victorians. Of course, every Victorian house had a chimney, and the only way of cleaning your chimney was to find a small child and to send the small child up the chimney with a brush. And there were all sorts of terrible stories about this. For example, if the child got stuck, one of the ways of getting the child unstuck or encouraging the child to get unstuck was to light a fire underneath. So with the heat and the smoke, the child would find a way of getting free, etc. So really hideous stuff. And Blake was a very sensitive man. And so, for example, once he saw a child literally chained up, and this provoked a huge reaction in him in terms of both the treatment of children and, of course, in terms of slavery. All of these people, as we saw when we looked at Mary Wollstonecraft, are hugely against slavery, against child labour, in favour of animal rights. A number of them are vegetarians, people like Shelley are vegetarian, etc., etc. So an awful lot of modern sort of youth, lefty, progre, whatever you want to call it, culture, comes from these people. I mean, it's fascinating quite how they managed to capture multiculturalism, anti-racism, animal rights, vegetarianism, all of the types of things that you would think sound sort of very 21st century, probably, in Spain, were actually part of this non-conformist culture at the time. And in terms of his art, you can basically understand art in two ways. There's art which tries to create the fiction of solidity, and there's art which is curvilinear. Okay, so Gothic art, especially international Gothic, tends to respect the flatness of the picture surface, and it's all about creating beautiful lines. Yeah? But because what you're painting is heaven, usually, typically the Virgin and the child or this, that, and the other, some type of altar piece, why would you want to paint it realistically? I mean, there's this myth that in the Renaissance, people rediscovered perspective, people rediscovered creating realistic, solid images. Well, to start off with, it's only realistic from one precise point. If you look at a picture from any other angle, it looks distorted. But apart from that, how do you know that God looks heavy and lumpy and has a big beard, etc., etc.? If you're painting something which is spiritual, you might as well paint it in two dimensions, which is more honest, and with beautiful lines, etc., rather than creating the fiction of a pictorial space, which is really just a little type of theatre, in the sense that you have a box and you're looking through a window. So Blake goes back to the medieval tradition of illuminated manuscripts, the idea that this sort of modern idea that comes with the periodical essays and print, that mass-produced texts are just texts. Like, have you seen Chinese newspapers?
What?
Chinese newspapers.
They're written in
Chinese, correct. But also, they tend to have very, very few photos. They tend to be lots of little Chinese symbols. And of course, that is basically how most of the newspapers are at this time. You don't have the sort of wonderful sort of Daily Mail thing where you have huge, big, kind of nice, big colour photo, little bits of writing for you to vaguely focus on. It's all writing. And again, you know, eventually you have the illustrated news, and the Times had little illustrations and stuff like that. But basically, it's about the writing. Yeah, much more serious in that sense. But that isn't actually a very good way of learning. And semiotics and all of the modern studies of how to learn say that the best way to learn is combinations of mind maps and pictures and videos and text, and that all of these things combine together. And that is actually how the human brain digests information best. And again, Blake is hugely advanced in that sense, that it's much better to have a text with illustration than just to create a text. And he actually is one of the very, very few people with the ability to combine these things successfully. In fact, in the British tradition anyway, the only other great painter-poet is Gabriel Dante Rossetti, who we will see in April. Gabriel Dante Rossetti is not as great an artist, as far as I'm concerned. He's one of the great Pre-Raphaelite artists, but he's not as great an artist as Blake, and he's certainly not as great a poet as Blake. But there's nobody else in that type of relationship of doing the two things. And you ought to be very careful about this, because what happens with Blake is he's never just illustrating his texts. He's always providing a contrast or a commentary on the text. So it's never, here's what I'm saying and here's what I'm saying again, in a sort of mindless way. There is a contrast there. And people who only study, for example, the tiger, often sort of laugh at the fact that you've got this smiley little tiger in the bottom corner. Why do you have a smiley tiger? He didn't know how to draw tigers. Well, yes, he did, actually. But there is a contrast there. And once you look at the whole of, for example, Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience, you see that contrasting type of situation is constant. And if it's constant, it's not a mistake. It's not that he can't draw tigers. It's that they are commenting on things, that they're commenting on things, they're reacting on things, they're asking for further thought from you. Because what is happening here is he is taking another popular genre of the time, picture books for children. So you have typically, if you think of, if you've seen picture books from the time of Paquito, where you have, you know, the story of a saint's life and then pictures of the saint and this sort of thing. And it's all very heavily moralistic. And that's very much what was happening at the time here. You'd have these picture books of saints' lives or good people's lives, etc., etc. They'd be teaching you moral, and they'd be teaching you where a woman's place was and how a man should be behaving. And it's all very, very conservative and about getting conformity into children. By the way, the other person who reacts against this tradition is, of course, C.S. Lewis. The whole thing with Alice in Wonderland is also about exploding moralistic stories for children and exciting the imagination of children. So what you tend to get, here is contrasts with the images, and in many, many cases, questions. The whole of the tiger is questions. The tiger does not assert anything. Everything in the tiger is questions. What this is about provoking thought, not telling you what to think. And of course, many, many later socialists or Marxists or whatever are about indoctrination. But Blake is not about indoctrination, about making you think, making you wonder, making you marvel at the world. And the rhyme scheme he's using again is a popular rhyme scheme. He's using the rhyme scheme of trochaic tetrameters, which is the type of rhyme scheme we get in Jack Be Nimble, Jack Be Quick, Jack Jump Over the Candlestick, and all of those nursery rhymes, etc. Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill, blah, 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 blah. All of those nursery rhymes, those ballads, tend to use that type of rhyme scheme. It's faster, it's more immediate. And so there is the impression of simplicity, of almost childishness about most of these things. But of course, what it actually provokes is a much, much deeper level of thought than anything Wordsworth is capable of. Sorry, I mustn't be so nasty about Wordsworth. So it's all about subverting these genres. It's all about engaging with the reader, engaging with the viewer of the art, and getting people to think. It's incredibly important that you think as a child, that you come up with your own ideas, that you don't just accept the ideas that are given to you. That infernal method, as he calls it, infernal sounds bad, but it's just in relation to the method of the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which is one of his later books, is how you maintain innocence and how you grow in experience. So another element that we have here, and this is very much developed in his later theology, later philosophy. Blake is also a massive philosopher and has a huge understanding of the human brain, an incredibly advanced understanding of the human brain. There is the basic idea that the left hemisphere is about rational thought, and the right hemisphere is about imagination. Yes, the two things interact and are connected, and it's slightly more complicated than that. And most human thought involves both hemispheres. But that basic fundamental idea of the dichotomy of the human brain is still a fundamental idea in neuroscience. And that is how Blake perceives the world, how Blake perceives poetry, etc., etc. You have this conflict between the energy of imagination and the deadening effect of reason. And he is much more about stimulating imagination rather than killing imagination through reason. And what you have is, therefore, a rejection, quite a strong rejection, which links back to our friends, the Gothics. Links back to our friends, the Gothics, with the idea of rejecting neoclassicism. Not everything comes from Rome. Not everything, all human ideas, all human thought comes from Rome and Greece. There are other ways of thinking. And the Roman, Greek, logical, crushing rationalism is not necessarily a good thing. Freeing up your imagination is also a good thing. And so again, a hugely important idea, again, is the sublime, which obviously does go back to the Romans with Longinus. But I've always actually been, does anybody know if there's any connection between Longinus and Longinus? Yeah. Longinus is the Roman soldier who pierced Christ's chest and the water and the blood came out. And Longinus, we don't know anything about Longinus. He's actually sometimes called the false Longinus, apart from the book on the sublime. And so I was just wondering whether Longinus was given the name Longinus, the guy who wrote the book, by Christians in relation to that ultimately sublime act of piercing the God figure. But I don't know. I mean, I've always found it rather surprising. There's only two people in history called Longinus, and they're both rather connected with the sublime. Anyway, infant joy. I have no name, I am but 2 days old. What shall I call thee? I happy am, joy is my name, sweet joy before thee. Pretty joy, sweet joy but 2 days old. Sweet joy I call thee, thou dost smile, I sing a while, sweet joy before thee. Incredibly simple, silly little poet, but incredibly ambiguous and incredibly provocative, and we'll see why. Infant joy. What does that title mean?
Happiness.
It could be the infancy of happiness, where happiness comes from, a newborn baby. It could be the infancy of a baby called Joy. Joy is the name of is a perfectly good name in English. Could be something else. The joy of an infant, the happiness of an infant. Where does the happiness of an infant come from? With the relationship with the parent, with the mother. It could be all of those things together. So the title is ambiguous and is open to multiple interpretation. There's this idea initially that the baby has no name. The only possible name for the baby is I Am. Anybody else called I Am? God and Christ. Yeah, in Exodus 3, 13 to 14, Moses asks God his name, and God replies, I Am. And in John 8, 58, Jesus adopts the name I Am. So one of the things that Blake is potentially suggesting is that babies are divine. Babies are horrible, but that's nothing. But the idea that there is a divinity in babies. Babies, for romantics, for people from the time of Rousseau onwards, have come recently from directly being in the presence of God. Okay? Calvinist, horrible, nasty Calvinist ideas are that babies are born with original sin. Babies have sinned before they were even born. Horrible, nasty things. We have to purify the baby by baptizing it because it's already sinned. It's already full of sin. That is completely rejected by the Romantics. Okay? And you have a completely opposite idea. Babies come directly from God, so they are pure innocence, and in that sense, they are, in some sense, divine. So, this baby, which is full of innocence, when left alone to determine its own nature, the baby names itself, finds joy rather than guilt or repression. Guilt or repression are what comes from society. Naturally, we are innocent and beautiful and giving beings. Society is what makes us selfish and repressed. So, the infant is the embodiment, is the incorporation of innocent happiness. She needs succor and reassurance, both verbal, sweet joy befall thee, there's an incantation there on the baby, so the baby will be happy, and non-verbal, the euphony there is in the poem, the repetition of open vowel sounds, etc. So we have a combination of a sort of nursery rhyme, a conversation between a mother and a two-day-old baby. Now, of course, formally, there's no conversation to be had with a two-day-old baby. If you're lucky, the baby will burp or cry. Those are your options. But of course, there is a communication between a mother and a two-day-old baby. They do communicate. They don't communicate in words. They communicate at another level. And that is also what's being talked about there. So, is this joyous innocence simply the lack of cruel experience in the world? The opposite, if you like, the contrast of innocence. Is it possible to maintain the childlike innocence throughout one's adult life? If so, is the birth of this lifelong joyous innocence the result of vital succor and reassurance from a young age? Reminds me of a poster and when I was a teenager in England, with a rather strange poster, I suppose, in one sense, but somebody sort of forcing a baby's bottle into a baby's mouth, like that. And the title of this was that racists are not born, they're made, in the sense that people who are antisocial, aggressive, etc., etc., are the product of a cruel environment. They're not, there's nothing natural about being racist or about being aggressive towards other people who are different from them. So, notice the level of repetition. Repetition in any normal context of poetry would probably be seen as rather a bad thing. But repetition is part of magic, is part of incantation. We say joy 6 times, I 6 times, thee 4 times, sweet 4 times. It's a very limited language, like the language of a baby, or motherese, the language that mothers use to speak to babies. And notice the number of long vowels, E, R, those types of vowels, and diphthongs, A, I, O, etc. There's a lot of glides, especially the dark all, yeah, the all sounds. So we have name, am, shall, call, fall, while, smile. Those are fully rounded sounds that are euphonic for us. So we have the language of the nursery rhyme, the language of the lullaby, the language of a prayer, the language of incantation. This is a type of magical blessing, over this newborn child. It might seem a little bit extreme to suggest that the simple fact of the I am makes a reference to God and Christ. But of course, if you see the illustration that comes with the poem, which is in the notes, what we have is a picture which is very, very similar to a Madonna and child with a fairy or an angel blessing the baby. So the idea that the baby is Christ-like or God-like is reinforced by the picture. The picture, as you can see it in the notes, is a flower opening, and inside there is this mother and child and either fairy or baby. So, the companion poem, which was made on the back of, you have your metal sheet, and you can reuse that, you can recycle it by using the other side. And on the back of Infant Joy, we have Infant Sorrow, in terms of the metal sheet that was used. My mother groaned, my father wept, into the dangerous world I leapt. Helpless, naked, piping loud, like a fiend, hid in a cloud. Struggling in my father's hands, striving against my swaddling bands, bound and weary, I thought best to sulk upon my mother's breast. Again, this could be, infant sorrow could be the sorrow of a newborn baby, the sorrow produced by a newborn baby, the infancy, the origins of sadness, or perhaps all of those things at the same time. Obviously, unlike Spanish, Dolores, or whatever, is not a name in English. But Dolores is, actually. Quite a lot of Irish girls are called Dolores. But sorrow is not a name in English, so there's not that idea of... it couldn't actually be the child's name. So, this child comes into a world fearful of the future, oppressed by the father and the role of the father, and finally settles down into hypocritical sulking. Very, very early on, this baby, born into a negative context, learns that its best way of surviving is playing one parent off against another, using one parent against the other, as so often happens with children. So our perception of the world and that of those around us is what makes the world safe or dangerous, innocent or cruel. Often in situations of poverty, you have children that are born that are not wanted. It's yet another child. How are we going to feed it, etc.? And that child receives these negative ideas, absorbs them, and recreates them. Notice how the child is bound. Who else is bound? This child is bound in the sense that it's swaddled, yeah? Well, the first thing you want to do to a child traditionally is to wrap it very tightly up so that it can't move, it's being restricted, being limited. Who else is bound?
Moses.
But no, Moses isn't that important for the romantics. Who is the most important or the second most important figure for the romantics? Prometheus. Remember, we have Prometheus Unbound is a play by Shelley, but Prometheus is this hugely important figure, this individual, this overreacher who challenges the gods and steals fire for humanity. He is seen as and suffers the consequences. So Prometheus is very much a Christ figure for the Romantics. Christ is a Christ figure for the Romantics as well, even though a number of the Romantics, like Shelley, are atheists. They are huge fans of Jesus Christ. There's no dichotomy between, there's no problem for somebody like Shelley to think that Christ and Christ's teaching are excellent and Christianity is rubbish. So both ideas can come together. But that idea is important. The baby takes on this defensive role of a fiend, of a devil, in a cloud. The baby, babies very soon learn that the best way to get what they want is to be unbearable and make that horrible, horrible, horrible noise that babies make, and people will do whatever they want just to make them shut up. I don't know. So the first quatrain and a half of the second Second, include words full of energy, such as groaned, leaped, piping, struggling, striving, while the last couplet gives up in defeat, bound, weary, sulked. Yeah, so we have this idea of expansion and then contraction in the poem. The lively child has given way to the world-weary infant in moments. The poem appears foreshortened. Yeah? It seems like the poem should go on and it just suddenly stops. This, in one sense, is purposeful. This, in one sense, is the fact that this is the beginning of so many lives. So many lives begin with parental neglect, unhappy homes, and the child perpetuating this negativity. But it has also to be said that this was in Blake's first draft. There was another 6 stanzas about the competition between the rivalry between the baby and the father. But he made lots of attempts to try to fix these 6 later stanzas and then abandoned them and left the poem as this. And it's much better as this. What happens in the illustration is we simply, the father is simply absent. There's just this baby crying and the mother going to try to stop it crying. The mother who looks very tired, has to be said. So, the tiger. The tiger is probably one of the 3 or 4 most famous poems in the English language. It is a poem which, one of the few poems which probably 20% of Anglos can repeat the first 2 lines of. There is a very, very big poetic deficit in the Anglosphere amongst British and American people. People just don't know poetry as they should do. But this is one of the few poems that people will recognize very quickly. This is probably Blake's best known poem, apart from perhaps Jerusalem. Jerusalem is famous because it was turned into a hymn by Elgar or something like that. Elgar?
Yes.
What? Is that not Elgar?
I heard it on YouTube on the current number 4.
Yeah.
Everybody's singing there.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is something, it is a sort of alternative national anthem, if you like. For example, when the sort of great musical event of the year in London is the prom in the Royal Albert Hall, which is a week of music. And the last night of the prom, you have everybody sort of half drunk singing this together. So it's a little bit like the English version of Auld Lang Syne for the Scots, or that sort of thing. My love is like a rose for the Scots. That type of thing. It's something which is seen as this great expression of nationalism. It's hugely ironic because this is a great socialist hymn. This is a great hymn about how the country is horrible, but the country could be beautiful. The country could be great if people adopted socialist values and rejected industrialization. So it's an ecological socialist hymn about a possible future. It's not a hymn about what a wonderful place Great Britain is, which is how people sing. But anyway, it's very, very common for people to sing songs and not even think about the words that they're singing. But anyway, that's another question. What we have here is this poem, which often is presented to children as basically a children's nursery rhyme, because it's about a tiger. And children like tigers, especially smiley tigers, like the tiger at the bottom of the page. This poem probably has more doctoral theses written about it than any other single short poem. So it's a poem which people read at the age of 6, and they are still studying once they've finished their degrees in English and their masters in English at a doctoral level. And the more you study this poem, the more you can get out of it. We have a poem or something, what is it, 18 lines or something like that? And I have 12 pages of notes about it, and I'm just scratching the surface. So, one of the major ideas about this poem is symmetry. There is symmetry between the stanzas, there is symmetry between the lines, and there is symmetry within the lines. However, interestingly, the one place where the symmetry of the rhyme is broken is on the word symmetry. See? Yeah. Now, that is possibly just an old pronunciation. Shakespeare would have pronounced oi symmetry. So Shakespeare would have rhymed oi and symmetry. And if you go to recordings of Shakespeare's original pronunciation, you can hear that, that usage. But really, the change between early modern English and modern English, what's called modern English, takes place over the second half of the 18th century. So most people by this stage are now saying symmetry and I, and clearly distinguishing between those two. It's a type of rhyme which would have been a real rhyme for John Donne, but it's more of an I rhyme here. But it's just about possible, although he may be making a point of making the non-symmetry on the word symmetry, which is quite clever, really. And, of course, the fact that we have the repetition of the first and the last verse highlights the fact that could is changed to dare. Yeah? The only difference between the first verse and the last verse is that could is changed to dare. So, as I say, the poem is completely made up of questions, and one of the important things here is ambiguity. It's what your reader responds to the poem, not what the poem is telling you. You have to decide what the poem is about. There is an active process. This is really interactive poetry. It's not, I went to 3 miles and 5 miles above Tintern Abbey, and I found that this was the case, and this is my truth, and you have to accept it because I'm Wordsworth. Now this is trying to get you to think, to stimulate you to think, to come to your own conclusions, to stimulate your imagination. And there is clearly a purposeful attempt to use ambiguous language. The reason why literature is important is because we can have several mutually exclusive conclusions about something at the same time. Spanish people are obsessed about world ratings and about European ratings. So Spain is 32nd in the world rating for mathematics at schools, and so the country is never going to be successful, and this is terrible. It's hysterical, this, if you come from Britain. In Britain, we never, ever mention world ratings. We don't care what's happening in Korea. That's their problem. We know we're the best. So that type of thing is not a worry. But specifically, that type of thing is what you want in a Confucianist conformity-based society. It's very important that in China there is one calculation and one solution. In Korea there is one calculation, one solution. Because those are conformity-based societies. That, in fact, is not probably a very good preparation for the modern world. Because in the modern world, what happens is that there are different ways of analyzing things and different conclusions. And your mind has to be trained to think in a way which can accept the mutual existence of contradictory conclusions. And that is what literature is for. Literature teaches you to accept multiple conclusions which are mutually exclusive, and for them to exist in your brain at the same time. And one of the ways of provoking that is to use language which is evocative in the sense of having multiple meanings, and even to use contradictonyms. What are contradictonyms? I think there are no contradictonyms in Spanish, but in English there are at least 12 words which mean one thing and the exact opposite. It's wonderful.
Yes.
Yes. What?
For example, Westbird. In common language, it means the person who is hostile. But in botanics, it means the virus.
Uh-huh. Okay. So,
what is the person who hostess?
Yeah, all right, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the sort of idea. Right.
Person who hosts.
All right. So yeah, that's very much the idea. So we have words like to sanction. Sanction can be to justify or to penalize. To cleave can be to join together or to cut in two. Wonderful language. And we have, do we have cleave here? We have cleave in one of the poems by Shelley that we're going to see. Dread. Dread can mean fearful or fearsome. It can provoke fear or can cause fear, or it can receive fear. Yeah? In the same way that if we say something is awesome, that can create or can receive awe. Okay? There's the word like frame. Now, you probably know frame from Who Framed Roger Rabbit, yes? To frame in American 20th century American English can mean to create false evidence against somebody. How do you say that in Spanish?
No.
Well, okay. I mean, the translation is kin en gangue. Yeah, okay. But typically, for example, what the American police do in films, they frame somebody by planting drugs on them or something. But that is not the case here because that is the 20th century meaning. But at the time, at the time, frame could mean to shape or to make, to imagine, to describe, to turn something into a work of art, or to control and restrain. So there's huge amounts of evocative meanings that reflect out from that one word, and that your interpretation of the word frame can influence how you understand the rest of the poem. You can read the poem with each, read it with what the first meaning, read it with the second meaning, read it with the third meaning, read it with the fourth meaning, and each time your understanding of what the poem means will change. So, the poem is potentially asking about the nature of a God who can make such a beautiful but such a deadly thing as a tiger. So, there is possibly a question of theodicy. Do you understand theodicy? Theodicy, I suppose. Yeah. The idea that if God is good, how come there's evil in the world? Which is a huge problem for medieval scholars. Yeah? And of course the justification is that we have free will, we have libre albedrio, and that's why there's evil in the world, blah 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 blah. But that sort of idea, how is it that we have something like a tiger which is immensely beautiful, in fact is actually mesmerizing, and has that effect often on animals and I think on people as well. I mean, you could imagine if a tiger is advancing at you, just being in that sort of a situation like a rabbit in the headlights of a car, where you just freeze, there's no way, you don't know how to react. We are talking about the last thing that can kill human beings that is left in the world at this time, in that sort of majestic sense. It's bigger, stronger, greater, more magnificent than us. Okay. Obviously, there are scorpions and there are snakes and there are nasty things and there are viruses. Sorry. But I mean, we're talking about the last things. Okay. Yes. Okay. There are and there are lions. But the tiger, a bear is a huge thing. It's a strong thing, but it's not majestic. It's not beautiful in the same way. No, I mean, lovely bears. Yes, I'm not saying there's anything nasty about bears. But the beauty of a tiger and the beauty of a bear is not the same thing. A tiger is pretty objectively more beautiful than a lion. Even though a lion is majestic, there is that additional element just of the multicoloredness, the fact of the way that it blends into its environment, etc., gives it an extra level in that sense. The poem could also be asking, is the poem asking about the nature of the poet who dares or is able to describe such a perfect creature? Is it possible in words to create something as beautiful as what there is in reality? Is it possible in words and in images to create what something that is as beautiful as what there is in the as in reality? One of the great romantic ideas, and Coleridge is big on this as well, is that the poet, as a type of creator, is a type of God. The poet wills things into existence. Yeah? The poet is an incantor, is a magician who creates a reality. And in that sense, of course, the poet artist, like Blake, is an even bigger God figure. Does the tiger represent the untamable materials of the imagination? Is the tiger the fear that we have of the imagination, especially the fear of the dark? In the forest of the night, of course, is in that darkness, that impenetrable darkness, when our imagination is free because we're in a completely solipsistic world. If you're sleeping, you're sleeping alone or whatever in complete darkness. The only thing that exists is you, yourself, and your imagination. And that imagination can be incredibly beautiful, but can also have elements of sublimity and be incredibly threatening. Again, depending on your level of innocence and experience. Does the tiger represent the indomitable nature, the indomitable in the natural world outside, the natural world outside, and the untamable desires and drives of the human mind? One of the things that Blake believed, one of the reasons why he rejected conventional Christianity, was his attitude was that sex and naturalness and nakedness was hard enough without all of the Judeo-Christian blame and guilt and things related to it. He was very much believed in sort of free love, and supposedly he and his wife wandered around their garden naked, etc., etc. Again, sounds incredibly late 20th century, 21st century, nudists, etc., etc. But those are these new ideas are being generated by these people at the time. How does the tiger of the imagination compare with the tiger of the Indian forest? Why is there such a juxtaposition between the tame-looking, often smiling tiger, Blake illustrates in the bottom of the page, and the tiger with a Y in the poem? It's not exactly a tiger. It's not a tiger te y latina. It's a tiger te y griega. There's something more mythical, something older, more ancient about the tiger of the poem than the tiger of the Indian forest. Can the artist really frame something that is physically alive and three-dimensional as the tiger is in words and ink? One of the problems, of course, of writing is that you are describing in black and white. It's like a black and white picture. You are connecting with the imagination, but you're not connecting with the colourful elements of the imagination. And so there is a difference between black and white of ink and the black and white of the ink of an illustration. Again, is his or her fear of trying paralleled by our fear of the beast in the dark? Artists generally have a lot of problems with, I'm not going to be able to achieve it, I'm not going to be able to create my great work. And the fear of not succeeding can also be an element that is represented by the tiger. Is this meta-literature as it is reflected on the creative process of poetry, especially visionary poetry, the kind of poetry that communicates deep truths about the universe, often concerning the divine or a higher power? T.S. Eliot famously said that poetry often communicates before we understand it. So there is a deeper sense that through the sounds and the rhymes and the meter and some of the meaning of the words, that poetry can affect us, can influence us before we fully understand it. That is part of the incantatory nature of poetry. In the same way as, I don't know if this sort of thing happens in Spanish, I must do to some extent, although not necessarily in this context, but typically, English children, because the Lord's Prayer, because the Pater Noster is in early modern English, they don't properly understand it. So, for example, Our Father which art in heaven, I understood hallowed be thy name, as hallowed be, like it's just a word, for until I was sort of eight or something like this. Famously, another child's interpretation is, Our Father which art in heaven, Harold be thy name, as if God is called Harold, etc., etc. There is a hugely incantatory element about a lot of what you say in religious contexts. It is important to be repeating the words rather than necessarily understanding the words. And of course that is part of the positive and the negative thing of using Latin as a religious language. Latin becomes, for the majority of people, a sort of magic language. And in English we have a number of expressions like hocus pocus or abracadabra, which are what we call pig Latin. There are charlatans imitating Latin, hocus pocus, Latin words tend to end in cus type sounds. And by saying Latin things, you're using the magic of Latin to create magic. And so there are those effects of language that we don't understand. And of course, English nursery rhymes are absolutely full of little phrases which mean absolutely nothing formally. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Hi-ho, hi-ho. Hickory, dickory, dock. Knick-knack, paddywhack. All of those types of things mean formally nothing. Now, I say formally nothing because almost any Anglo can instantly say, this comes from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. This comes from Hickory Dickory Dock, the mouse ran up the clock. This comes from another nursery rhyme, etc., etc. Yeah? They're hardwired into our minds. And it's quite clear that small children love those types of sounds, even though they are meaningless, simply because of the euphony in those sounds, the sound repetition. And so there is that element there. There is also ambiguity in a phrase like, did the stars throw down their spears? Are the stars abandoning their weapons, or are they defending themselves in the fifth stanza? To throw down your spear could mean, run away! Yeah? Or it could be to throw down your spear from on high, attacking the tiger. Probably we would understand the second, except for the fact that in a later poem, in the four Zoas, Blake says, the stars threw down their spears and fled naked away. So we actually have Blake in another context using the first meaning. So we just don't know what's happening there with the stars. Do the stars, which are cold, recognize that they cannot compete with the beast which is burning bright? The stars are cold things in the sky compared to the tiger, which is burning, which represents fire, life, as in Zoroastrianism, Parsiism, etc., etc., again relating to India. The life force of a tiger is stronger than the death nuclear reaction of a star. Who is in control of the poem? Is it the artist? Is it God? Is it the tiger? We can understand any of those three. Why is the tiger smiling in the picture? If we only had the poem, we would say that God or the artist, but in the picture, sorry, who is smiling? Did he smile as well to see? If we only had the poem, we would think, okay, that's about the artist or God. But since the tiger is smiling in the picture, that would suggest that perhaps it is the tiger. Is the tiger a type of God figure that creates itself? And that's another possibility. So, we have the tiger as some sort of metaphorical thing. It's a tiger with a Y, it's not a tiger with an I. And this tiger obviously is not born from a tiger. Excuse me, it's not a natural tiger. This tiger is forged by a blacksmith. You know, it's made with hammer and tongs and chains and an anvil and things like that. So the tiger is perhaps a symbol of the Industrial Revolution. The tiger is quite possibly a symbol of the working class. What the Industrial Revolution creates, a monster like Frankenstein's creature, which can destroy the creator. The tiger, the working class, for somebody like Blake, is alienated from their work. Blake believes very strongly in work in the sense of Werken, auf Deutsch. Yeah? Werken is creative work. Yeah? But he rejects toil. Toil is mind-numbing work. The sort of work in a factory where you're tightening four screws on a factory line all day long. 12 hours a day tightening those four screws. Or putting the back on somebody's iPhone in a Chinese factory with your, you've seen them where they're connected to the desk. So they're not literally chained to the desk in these factories that create your iPhones and your iPads, etc. But they are connected to the desk so that whenever they get up from their desk to go to the toilet, to have a cigarette or whatever, that time is deducted. We want a symbol of modern slavery. It is that. People being electronically connected to their workbench so that any time that they spend on having a sandwich or going to the toilet is deducted from their wage. Incredible. To have to be connected to the work. No? Well, of course, the modern reality, of course, is that type of work is increasingly irrelevant. In the new factory, I think, for Mango in Galicia is going to have one worker, the person who turns the thing on and turns the thing off. Otherwise, there are no employees. Everything is automated. Incredible. Anyway, such is the future. Was the tiger created by a Promethean figure challenging God and the stars? Is the tiger the creation of a Miltonic Satan in the same way as the lamb, Christ, is the creation of God? Of course, we have this idea, the tiger is on the back of the sheet of the lamb, that they are the contrasting poems. Is the tiger somehow the opposite of that? Does the tiger represent French Jacobinism? What are you talking about, Nick? Actually, this is a very real possibility. The French Revolution and the Terror were quite regularly described with tiger similes in this period. The Times on the 7th of January, 1792, and again on the 26th of July, 1793, described the French revolutionaries as tigers. In 1792, Samuel Romilly said, one might as well think of establishing a republic of tigers in some forest in Africa. Why the tigers were in Africa, we don't know. That's not the question. There is this idea of tigers in forests being like revolutionaries. And in the same way as somebody like Mary Wollstonecraft says, you're saying we're like a blinded elephant. Think the beginning of Dumbo, yeah? You've seen Dumbo? You must have seen Dumbo, yeah? Mary Wollstonecraft compares the French Revolution to a blinded elephant that's being tormented by people, and the elephant lashes out and destroys everything around them, and is justified in doing that because it's being oppressed. In the same way, potentially Blake is saying, you're saying that we revolutionaries are like tigers. Fine, we're like tigers. Yeah? A tiger can be a symbol of some terrible type of curse against humanity. Or you can say, okay, we're the Tamil tigers, for example, in Sri Lanka. Yeah? We are this aggressive animal and we're going to destroy you. If that's how you want to portray us, if that's how you want to see us, then fine. There were other newspaper references to the tribunal of tigers. At a later date, Marat's eyes were said to resemble those of a tiger cat. There's all sorts of references here to tigers. Wordsworth described post-revolutionary Paris, Wordsworth went to post-revolutionary Paris. He wasn't just sitting in London writing the Times, he was actually there. Said, a place of fear, defenseless as a wood where tigers roam. So again, it's very much this idea. Fascinatingly, there is a letter written by Benjamin Franklin, who died in 1790, but we don't know when the date of the letter is, and we don't know who it was to. But it says, I would advise you, therefore, not to attempt unchaining the tiger, but to burn this piece before it is seen by any other person. Now, there is a possible connection between Blake and Benjamin Franklin, and that, of course, is Thomas Paine, who was a friend of them both. So this very, very clearly, I mean, we don't have to be sort of silly new historicists saying, maybe he was floating about in the atmosphere in some canton in Switzerland. We have major national newspapers like the Times using it, major political commentators using it, and people who are friends of friends of Blake using this metaphor. So it clearly exists at the time. Another idea which is very strong at the time is and Blake says, the tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction. There is this idea of horses of instruction that goes back to Swift. Yeah, the Himenin in Gulliver's Travels are these very rational beings which are the horses. And Blake is saying the tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction. It's more important to destroy the establishment than to learn from it. And this seems to very much echo Marx's concept of philosophers have merely interpreted the world, the point is to change it. Or even Yeats's Easter 1916, A Terrible Beauty is Born. Ultimately, the tiger can represent anything that is fascinating and dangerous, from sexual passion to drugs, anything that causes you to lose control. The tiger is pure sublimity. Blah, 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 blah. So, talk a bit about sublimity, talk a bit more about theodicy. You ready?
No.
Talk a bit more about that. You're going to have to read the last 8 pages. one of the interesting elements is that the tiger may be related to India. India suddenly starts to have a big influence on Britain. Britain is conscious that, or certainly the more liberal people in Britain are conscious that by military superiority, they are conquering a profoundly rich culturally rich society in India, or group of societies in India. And there's all sorts of things that can be learned from India. And there's a great interest in Indian mythology, in Sanskrit, etc., etc. This is not the Native Americans in North America who, well, in many senses, however great their culture is, there's not a great written culture, a great artistic culture in the same way as there is in India. And one of the possibilities is that you have at this time, unlike bears, you have a situation at this time where quite regularly British settlers, British imperialists, are being killed by tigers. A lot of them are going around, you know, going, I'm going to go hunting tigers and going and killing tigers. But tigers are quite clever. And so you have quite a regular number of people being killed by, of British people being killed by tigers in India. As I say, in many cases, probably their own fault because they've gone hunting. But so there is this idea that this is a real animal that is a real challenge. And it's an animal that's not, you can't just say, look, I have a wavy bit of cloth, and the animal goes for the cloth rather than for you. Tigers are intelligent. So intelligent to the extent that in the 1970s, one of the villages in northern India realized that tigers will always try and attack you from behind. And so they went through the forest with face masks on the backs of their heads. And for about 10 years, this worked. Nobody was attacked by tigers. But after that, those 10 years, the tigers began to be able to distinguish the face mask from the front of people's faces, and they started to kill people again. So we're talking about clever animals. We're not talking about toros de lidia or anything like that. And you have, at this time, the British have one of their major problems in conquering India, which is a guy called Tipu Sultan, who is one of the great Mughal leaders in the north of India. And this is when the French are expelled from India, there's a power vacuum, and both he and the British are moving into the power vacuum, and they inevitably are confronted by each other. And this is somebody who, in many senses, is using quite modern technology. He is one of the forerunners of using rockets as a military device, especially as a psychological military device. In the same way as in, for example, in the Second World War, with the Soviets using, what are they called? I can't remember what they're called, but the psychological effect of the Soviets basically had lorries with firing multiple rockets off the top, and it's not actually very accurate, and it doesn't do a huge amount of damage, but the psychological effect of having multiple rockets fired onto you was hugely important in the period after Stalingrad, and this guy. This sultan was using this type of psychological warfare against the British at the time. And one of his nicknames was, of course, the Tiger of Mysore. So as an indigenous a leader combating British imperialism, he could be seen as a hero of somebody like Blake as well. He was overwhelmed by General Munro in 1792, but shortly after General Munro conquered Tipu Sultan's territory, Munro's son was killed by a tiger. And so this may all be very much related to this. One of the things I would like you to do as an extension activity, there is in the Victoria and Albert Museum something that looks like that. Can you see that? Okay, you will be able to see it in the notes when you come back. There's a camera looking at me. Oh, the camera's there. I can't be bothered to show you. You can look at it in the notes. This is an organ created at the time for Tipu Sultan. And the organ shows a tiger eating a British soldier, devouring a British soldier. And you can open it up and you can play the piano on it. But it is one of these symbols of India fighting back against the British. Now, this only came to England a decade after the tiger was written by Blake. So there can't be directly about this organ, but about the tiger as a symbol of Indian resistance to the British, it is very possible to exist. So, end of class. Going to be late for the next class.